Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion.
Hello. Please enjoy. If you tuned into the program before, I hope you've had a wonderful time since we last met. And to those who are just joining the program, welcome. We're going through a text in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition titled Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun by the Buddhist master Namgyal Pal. This is a commentary on another mind training text entitled The 7 Points of Mind Training, and it chiefly focuses on the intention to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, that is, bodhicitta. The text goes through the preliminary practices, the 2 ways of nurturing bodhicitta in our minds, and then how to act after we've decided to follow that intention. We've discussed Namgyal Pal's commentary in the preliminary practices and the ways of generating bodhicitta called 7 cause and effect, or 6 cause and 1 effect, and now we are discussing the method of exchanging self for others. This means exchanging our self-cherishing attitude with the attitude that cherishes others more than ourselves. But now, before continuing, let's think about our motivation for joining the program today. As I've often said, bodhicitta is the best kind of motivation that we can have because its focus is to benefit innumerable beings in the best way possible. So let's take a moment to think about our motivation and, if possible, reset it to bodhicitta if that's not what it already is. Of course, if you don't feel up to that, then at least motivate for your own liberation and enlightenment. In the 7-point mind training text, this section on developing bodhicitta through exchanging self for others comes in the form of succinct, instructive aphorisms like banish the one to blame for everything and meditate on the great kindness of all beings. We have discussed the first one, banish the one to blame for everything, the one being the self-centered attitude. We saw how this is the cause for all our suffering, from the slightest to the greatest. Recognizing this, we're then urged to meditate on the importance of others, because they are the source of all our happiness, from the smallest to the bliss of enlightenment. Over the last 2 programs, we have therefore been finding out what is meant by meditating on the great kindness of all beings. While thinking about the kindnesses we get from other beings, for one thing, we can see that without them, we couldn't use and enjoy all the things that we do. How can you make delicious chocolate cake without all the ingredients? And where do the ingredients come from? Of course, we can say we just go to the shop and buy them. But what if no one had set up a shop where we could buy what we needed? And what if no one had processed and packaged the ingredients? If no one had planted or harvested the raw materials? Can you see that every ingredient of the chocolate cake comes to us dependent on the kindness and activities of so many others? And this is true of everything we use. Looking at history, we find that countless others have had a hand in its coming into being. In other words, regardless of their intentions, others are continually kind to us. We even depend on them for our spiritual progress. If we want to develop our positive qualities and eliminate the negatives, it would be impossible without at least the presence of others. Even our enemies are helpful. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama often points out, if others didn't annoy us, how could we develop patience and overcome our impatience and anger? Our friends don't often give us reason to practice patience because they always try to be kind and helpful. But those we find annoying and our enemies invoke in us lots of material to work with. Now imagine being stuck in the company of someone like John Thorpe, the rude, overbearing, truth-despising character out of Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey. In a way, he might appear funny, but he's also very malicious. Here is his first outing in a horse and carriage with the heroine Catherine Morland, who's been staying with her friends Mr. and Mrs. Allen. John Thorpe is a friend of Catherine's brother, James. "You will not be frightened, Miss Morland," said Thorpe as he handed her in, "if my horse should dance about a little at first setting off. He will, most likely, give a plunge or two, and perhaps take a rest for a moment. But he will soon know his master. He's full of spirits, playful as can be, but there's no vice in him." Catherine did not think the portrait a very inviting one, but it was too late to retreat, and she was too young to own herself frightened. So, resigning herself to her fate and trusting to the animal's boasted knowledge of his owner, she sat peaceably down and saw Thorpe sit down by her. Everything being then arranged, the servant who stood at the horse's head was bid in an important voice to let him go, and off they went in the quietest manner imaginable, without a plunge or a caper or anything like one. Catherine, delighted at so happy an escape, spoke her pleasure aloud with grateful surprise, and her companion immediately made the matter perfectly simple by her assuring her that it was entirely owing to the peculiarly judicious manner in which he had held the reins, and the singular discernment and dexterity with which he had directed his whip. Catherine, though she could not help wondering that with such perfect command of his horse he should think it necessary to alarm her with a relation of its tricks, congratulated herself sincerely on being under the care of so excellent a coachman, and perceiving that the animal continued to go on in the same quiet manner without showing the smallest propensity towards any unpleasant vivacity, and considering its inevitable pace was 10 miles an hour, by no means alarmingly fast, gave herself up to all the enjoyment of air and exercise of the most invigorating kind, in a fine, mild day of February, with a consciousness of safety. A silence of several minutes succeeded their first short dialogue. It was broken by Thorpe saying very abruptly, "Old Alan is as rich as a Jew, is it not he?" Catherine did not understand him, and he repeated his question, adding in explanation, "Old Alan, the man you're with." "Oh, Mr. Alan, you mean? Yes, I believe he's very rich." "And no children at all?" "No, not any." "A famous thing for his next heirs. He's your godfather, is he not?" "My godfather? No." "But you're always very much with them." "Yes, very much." "Aye, that's what I meant. He seems a good kind of old fellow enough, and has lived very well in his time, I dare say. He's not gouty for nothing. Does he drink his bottle a day now?" "His bottle a day? No. Why should you think of such a thing? He's a very temperate man, and you could not fancy him in liquor last night." "Lord help you. You women are always thinking of men's being in liquor. Why do you not suppose a man is overset by a bottle? I'm sure of this, that if everybody was to drink their bottle a day, there would not be half the disorders in the world there are now. It would be a famous good thing for us all." "I cannot believe it." "Oh, Lord, it would be the saving of thousands. There's not the hundredth part of the wine consumed in this kingdom that there ought to be. Our foggy climate wants help. And yet I have heard that there's a great deal of wine drunk in Oxford." "Oxford? There's no drinking at Oxford now, I assure you. Nobody drinks there. You would hardly meet with a man who goes beyond his 4 pints at the utmost. Now, for instance, it was reckoned a remarkable thing at the last party in my rooms that upon an average we cleared about 5 pints a head. It was looked upon as something out of the common way. Wine is famous good stuff, to be sure. You would not often meet with anything like it in Oxford, and that may account for it. But this will just give you a notion of the general rate of drinking there." "Yes, it does give a notion," said Catherine warmly, "and that is that you all drink a great deal more wine than I thought you did. However, I'm sure James, that is her brother, does not drink so much." This declaration brought on a loud and overpowering reply, of which no part was very distinct except the frequent exclamations, amounting almost to oaths, which adorned it. And Catherine's left, when it ended, with rather a strengthened belief of there being a great deal of wine drunk in Oxford, and the same happy conviction of a brother's comparative sobriety. Thorpe's ideas then all reverted to the merits of his own equipage, and she was called on to admire the spirit and freedom with which his horse moved along, and the ease which his paces, as well as the excellence of the springs, gave the motion of the carriage. She followed him in all his admiration as well as she could. To go before or beyond him was impossible. His knowledge and her ignorance of the subject, his rapidity of expression and her diffidence of herself, put that out of her power. She could strike out nothing new in the commendation but she readily echoed whatever he chose to assert, and it was finally settled between them without any difficulty that his equipage was altogether the most complete of its kind in England, his carriage the neatest, his horse the best goer, and himself the best coachman. "You do not really think, Mr. Thorpe," said Catherine, venturing after some time to consider the matters entirely decided, and to offer some little variation on the subject, "that James's gig will break down?" "Break down? Oh, Lord, did you ever see such a little tittipity thing in your life? There's not a sound piece of iron about it. The wheels have been fairly worn out these last 10 years at least, and as for the body, upon my soul, you might shake it to pieces yourself with a touch. 'Tis the most devilish little rickety business I ever beheld. Thank God we have a better. I would not be bound to go 2 miles in it for £50,000. "Good heavens," cried Catherine, quite frightened. "Then pray let us turn back. They will certainly meet with an accident if we go on. Do let us turn back, Mr. Thorpe. Stop and speak to my brother and tell him how very unsafe it is." "Unsafe? Oh, Lord, what is there in that? They will only get a roll if it does break down, and there's plenty of dirt. It will be excellent falling. Oh, curse it. The carriage is safe enough if a man knows how to drive it. A thing of that sort in good hands will last above 20 years after it's fairly worn out. Lord bless you, I would undertake for £5 to drive it to York and back again without losing a nail." And so, John Thorpe is impressive, with his superior horse and carriage, his admirable horsemanship, his excellent wine, his loud voice, the many oaths he knows, his put-downs, and so on. Later, he persuades Catherine to go on another ride with him, even though she has promised to go walking in the country with other friends, Henry Tilney and his sister Eleanor. In the morning it rained, and consequently the Tilneys had not turned up at the agreed time. But John Thorpe, his sister Isabella, and Catherine's brother James did turn up in 2 carriages again, intending to take Catherine for a long ride. At first, Catherine was very unwilling, hoping her other friends would come in due course. But when Thorpe mentioned visiting Blaise Castle, a distant Gothic structure she was fascinated by, and also learning about the Tilneys themselves driving away in a carriage, she reluctantly agreed. And this is what happened. Catherine's feelings as she got into the carriage were in a very unsettled state, divided between regret for the loss of one great pleasure and the hope of soon enjoying another, almost its equal in degree, however unlike in kind. She could not think the Tilneys had acted quite well by her in so readily giving up their engagement and without sending her any message of excuse. It was now but an hour later than the time fixed for on the beginning of their walk, and in spite of what she had heard of the prodigious accumulation of dirt in the course of that hour, she could not, from her own observation, help thinking that they might have gone with very little inconvenience. To feel herself slighted by them was very painful. On the other hand, the delight of exploring an edifice like Udolpho, as her fancy represented Blaise Castle to be, was such a counterpoise of good as might console her for almost anything. They passed briskly down Putney Street and through Laura Place without the exchange of many words. Thorpe talked to his horse, and she meditated by turns on broken promises and broken arches, phaetons and false hangings, Tilneys and trapdoors. As they entered Argyle Buildings, however, she was roused by this address from her companion. "Who is that girl who looked at you so hard as she went by?" "Who? Where?" "On the right-hand pavement. She must be almost out of sight now." Catherine looked round and saw Miss Tilney leaning on her brother's arm, walking slowly down the street. She saw them both looking back at her. "Stop, stop, Mr. Thorpe," she impatiently cried. "It is Miss Tilney. It is indeed. How could you tell me they were gone? Stop, stop, I will get out this moment and go to them." But to what purpose did she speak? Thorpe only lashed his horse into a brisker trot. The Tilneys, who had soon ceased to look after her, were in a moment out of sight around the corner of Laura Place, and in another moment she herself whisked into Market Place. Still, however, and during the length of another street, she entreated him to stop. "Pray, pray, stop, Mr. Thorpe. I cannot go on. I will not go on. I must go back to Miss Tilney." But Mr. Thorpe only laughed, smacked his whip, encouraged his horse, made odd noises, and drove on. And Catherine, angry and vexed as she was, having no power of getting away, was obliged to give up the point and submit. Her reproaches, however, were not spared. "How could you deceive me so, Mr. Thorpe? How could you say that you saw them driving up the Lansdowne Road? I would not have had it happen so for the world. They must think it so strange, so rude of me, to go by with them too without saying a word. You don't know how vexed I am. I shall have no pleasure at Clifton nor anything else. I'd rather, 10,000 times rather, get out now and walk back to them. How could you say you saw them driving out in a phaeton?" Thorpe defended himself very stoutly, declaring he had never seen two men so much alike in his life, and would hardly give up the point of its having been Tilney himself. Their drive, even when this subject was over, was not likely to be very agreeable. Catherine's complaisance was no longer what it had been in their former airing. She listened reluctantly, and her replies were short. Blaise Castle remained her only comfort. Towards that, she still looked at intervals with pleasure, though rather than be disappointed of the promised walk, and especially rather than be thought ill of by the Tilneys, she would willingly have given up all the happiness which its walls could supply. The happiness of a progress through a long suite of lofty rooms, exhibiting the remains of magnificent furniture, though now for many years deserted. The happiness of being stopped in their way along the narrow winding vaults by a low grated door, or even of their having their lamp, their only lamp, extinguished by a sudden gust of wind, and of being left in total darkness. In the meanwhile, they proceeded on their journey without any mischance, and were within view of the town of Canesham, when a halloo from Morland, who was behind them, made his friend pull up to know what was the matter. The others then came close enough for conversation, and Morland said, "We'd better go back, Thorpe. It's too late to go on today. Your sister thinks so, as well as I. We've been exactly an hour coming from Pulteney Street, very little more than 7 miles, and I suppose we have at least 8 more to go. It will never do. We set out a great deal too late. We had better put it off till another day and turn around." "Oh, it's all one to me," replied Thorpe rather angrily, and instantly turning his horse, they were on their way back to Bath. "If your brother had not got such a damn beast to drive," he said soon afterwards, "we might have done it very well. My horse would have trotted to Clifton within the hour if left to himself, and I've almost broke my arm with pulling him into that cursed broken-winded jade's pace. Morland is a fool for not keeping a horse and gig of his own." "No, he's not," said Catherine warmly, "for I'm sure he could not afford it."
"And why cannot he afford it?"
"Because he has not money enough."
"And whose fault is that?"
"Nobody's that I know of." Thorpe then said something in the loud, incoherent way to which he had often recourse, about it being a damned thing to be miserly, and that if people who rolled in money could not afford things, he did not know who could, which Catherine did not even endeavour to understand. Disappointed of what was to have been the consolation for her first disappointment, she was less and less disposed either to be agreeable herself or to find her companion so, and they returned to Pulteney Street without her speaking 20 words. Now, how do we deal with people like this? Putting ourselves in Catherine's situation, what would we do? Of course, in our day and time, it's much easier to express raw emotion than it might have been in the more mannered Georgian England of Jane Austen. But can we keep our cool and not yield to negative emotions with the John Thorpes of this world? We're told in the mind training texts that these are the very people that give us the greatest opportunities to practice and so are most valuable to us. They also present us with the most danger. For if we do get angry with them and retaliate, we're setting ourselves up for some potentially very unpleasant karmic comeback in the future. We also move in the opposite direction from enlightenment. And so we're encouraged to use people like John Thorpe and the situations they led us into to develop patience and other positive qualities and curb our reactiveness. After all, don't we all have some John Thorpe qualities within ourselves? Namkar Pal emphasizes that our enemies and those we clash with provide our very path to enlightenment. He writes, "Our preceptor is extremely kind because he bestows the vows that are the cause for us to attain liberation and omniscience.
Our enemy too is like that, because by relying on him, we can perfect patience, which is a cause for great enlightenment. This is like the saying, don't spit out delicious food once it is in your mouth. And he quotes Shantideva's guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. Therefore, like finding a treasure in my house without any effort on my part, I should be delighted that my enemy becomes my friend in my efforts for enlightenment. And also, when anyone abuses me, or even when others do me harm, when they afflict me in ways such as these, may they all have the fortune to gain enlightenment. He also quotes Geshe Chikawa, whom we've already mentioned in the program of the 8 Verses of Mind Training, saying, even when hurt is offered in return for help, respond by meditating on great compassion. In this world, the superior man will accept such misfortune while leading others to goodness. He is saying that when we help others in the best way we can, and not showing any gratitude, they harm us in return, instead of being discouraged, disappointed, or angry, it's best to meditate on compassion for all beings, and especially the one harming us. When we remember that beings' minds are governed by afflictive emotions and negative karma, it becomes obvious that they cannot help but act in harmful and destructive ways. It's not their fault in the sense that they're actually choosing to act that way. If we have a strong grasping at an I and see that is the most important thing in the world, everything we will do will be in the service of that I. It's like a tyrant is in charge of us, and we believe that if we don't act as it directs, we'll be in for a lot of suffering. And do you think the person you have helped and who retaliates with harm would do so if they knew how much suffering they're causing both you and themselves? We're like children who insist on playing with poisonous snakes. Sooner or later, such kids will be bitten and go through so much suffering. But we're all a bit like that. We're fascinated and we go on playing with the snakes. Knowing this, superior persons don't blame those who harm them, but generate compassion for them instead. They take the long view, seeing the harm like a boomerang. It may initially be directed at them, but in the end, it always swings back to cause the most trouble for the person who first sent it on its way. As the Buddha said, holding on to anger is like grasping a hot coal with the intent of throwing it at someone else. You are the one who gets burned. Remember that famous story about the samurai and the monk? A big, tough samurai once went to see a little monk. Monk, he barked in a voice accustomed to instant obedience, teach me about heaven and hell. The monk looked up at the mighty warrior and replied with utter disdain, teach you about heaven and hell? I couldn't teach you about anything. You're dumb. You're dirty. You're a disgrace, an embarrassment to the samurai class. Get out of my sight. I can't stand you. The samurai got furious. He shook, red in the face, speechless with rage. He pulled out his sword and prepared to slay the monk. Looking straight into the samurai's eyes, the monk said softly, "That's hell." The samurai froze, realizing the compassion of the monk who had risked his life to show him hell. He put down his sword and fell to his knees, filled with gratitude. The monk said softly, "And that is heaven." Does this mean the samurai will never get angry and never draw his sword again? Maybe, but that would be very doubtful. At least now he has something to work on. Instead of being reactive to his anger, he can start slowly on the long path to transforming it. But to do that, he will still need the people he regards as his enemies. Though instead of killing them, he might set about killing his anger instead. Therefore, they will be very useful to him, much more useful than if he chopped their heads off. This is why His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in his commentary, says rather than flee our enemies, we should seek them out. The main trouble point is the enemy, the one who really gets us angry and uptight, someone who is really obnoxious and makes us really work hard not to get disturbed, he says. So we have to turn to someone who's really our enemy, somebody we hate, and try to develop the attitude of loving this person. We need to find concern and sympathy for this person, who only wants to be happy and try to develop real heartwarming love for someone whom we previously hated. If we can do that, it is something that is extremely intensive and extremely powerful. So the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life is really quite an amazing teaching because it provides such an extensive method. If we can develop such a heartwarming feeling of love and concern for someone that we previously hated and considered our enemy, we are really developing a very powerful tool of the mind and heart. And perhaps that gives more meaning to those verses from Shantideva. Therefore, like finding a treasure in my house without any effort on my part, I should be delighted that my enemy becomes my friend in my efforts for enlightenment. And also, when anyone abuses me, or even when others do me harm, when they afflict me in ways such as these, may they all have the fortune to gain enlightenment. And with that, we must now say farewell, for our time together is up. Please dedicate any positive potential from this program to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thanks for joining the program, and I hope you'll do so again next week. I look forward to it. Have a great week, and goodbye.
Someone that